Welcome to The Business of Platforms, a video podcast series where Vivaldi will be chatting with the world's leading marketers, thinkers, and innovators about the evolution of business and the exciting ways in which platforms are helping companies and brands deliver greater value.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Eric Joachimsthaler. I'm the founder and CEO of Vivaldi Group. I am with J.P. Kuhlwein. J.P. Kuhlwein is one of the most prolific marketers. He's been having a career at Procter & Gamble in various parts of the world. He's been in Asia, in baby care, laundry, in Europe, in the US. He has led various functions in operating management and strategic leadership, in managing premium brand strategies and innovation, new product development, and global strategic planning. JP, like me, shares an origin, Germany. First of all, I would like to say thank you for joining us, JP Kuhlwein.
Erich, it's a pleasure. I guess it might have been easier to do the whole thing in German as well.
Yes, then it would have been twice as long, I guess. What really sort of excites me to have you here is because you worked across many different categories, the major categories like detergent. You have been in the premiumization business, if you will, with premium brands in the beauty and healthcare business. And when I look at the businesses, you've been in businesses that what I characterize as pipeline businesses, so the traditional CPG, consumer product goods company business. And my question, and I hope we can explore this during the next few minutes, is the business of platforms a way to rethink CPG? Is, in your opinion, what ails the pipeline or the traditional CPG business, and might platform business models be a solution out?
Right. I guess I would say the short answer is probably yes. The longer-winded answer is, I mean, pipeline business, as you label it, was a great gig. And I was part of it when it really ran fantastically smoothly, and you could measure it in the financial results. As you said, I was part of P&G Laundry in the US. Then I actually moved to emerging markets, Southeast Asia in particular. And we had fantastic results that were built on building scale, an incredible moat, competitive moat, by having, a installed capital that was running incredibly efficiently, thus being able to offer decent to very good to the best products at competitive prices. And then, cracking it in terms of how to talk about those pipeline products in a way that at first, appeals to kind of the logic, talking about their functional benefits, and then to the emotion. So it was a great product, particularly working on Pampers. It was amazing to see this brand moving from, a couple of billion to 10 billion and more, basically a Fortune 500 company in and of itself. The challenge, as you said, has come over the last, I want to say, decade, maybe a little bit more. And I've been thinking a lot about, how it came about. I think it's a combination of reasons, but I would say it's a combination of, one, obviously, digital transformation and what that brought, which are elements of bringing transparency, bringing flexible supply chain opportunities, platforms, obviously, as we'll talk about. That combined with, I think, an economic, a deep economic crisis in the late part of the first decade that made consumers and people reflect about their spending, about what matters, about what they want to get out of products, the price they want to pay, compared with kind of a generational change as well, and a change in thinking about transparency, about what they want their consumption to stand for, about fast fashion and other things. I think those are like three key factors that have led to the rise of these platform brands, digitally enabled, millennial staffed, and facing a consumer who is learning quickly to want more, want participation, if you like, in the consumption, personalization that comes out of it, unlimited choice in the long tail. And that was just something that the scale, the pipeline players that are so much based on scale and on running one machine at very high speeds and churning out as much product as possible, have a very hard time competing with. You know, this kind of flexibility of personalization, overnight delivery, get it whenever, wherever you want, is just very tough for the scale machine to respond to. So long-winded answer to yes, I think, you know, platform is where it's going. And I think if these scale players can adapt to that, they can have a great, you know, resurgence.
Yes, and it seems to me that in the platform business can be entirely complementary, it seems almost, to the CPG traditional value chain and pipeline business. What I don't understand is why, if this is already a trend that has taken place 10 years now, as you said, sort of like, why does it take so long for the, why do the CPG have to get first in trouble, if I may say, until they react to new business models like the platform business?
Well, Erich, you're the professor. I'm new to teaching, but you know, let's say from a practical perspective, what I learned is it's incredibly tough for a scale-based traditional platform business to start to get used to give up what it considers its IP, its right to win, and to start sharing. So specifically, you know, I mean, at Procter & Gamble, you know, we were, and Procter & Gamble still is, almost paranoid about kind of the secrets of how you scale your business, you know, whether it's in supply chain, how that works, whether it's in, you know, pricing and margin management with retailers, whether it's your, you know, secrets of how to build a brand equity and translate it to effective advertising or, you know, buying media. All of these are considered competitive advantages that are secrets. A platform is all about collaboration and sharing. Yes. It's about, in many cases, not even owning the capital and or some of the IP expertise knowledge. Whereas the traditional pipeline business is all about, you know, at least owning kind of the key capital that is at the base of your scaling. So again, specifically on Pampers, you know, those machines running the diaper production literally would have parts on it that was that were called black boxes, where the minimum amount of people would be able to even see how it works, because it was considered and still is considered such a intellectual property and moat. So in that situation, opening up to start sharing knowledge, start moving out capital on both ends towards suppliers as well as towards consumers is an incredibly tough thing to do. Now, I think, you know, during that last decade and longer, companies like P&G and other big CPG, FMCG players opened up in little pieces. So for example, I remember a program, Connect and Develop by P&G R&D, which was all about collaborating with other researchers, material suppliers, etc. And, you know, obviously on, let's say, the other end of the funnel, you know, on the marketing side, we always operated through agencies and, you know, a lot of the brand development happened there. So there were spots where collaboration happened and where increasingly there was pressure to open up in IT, the same thing, you know, let other people, you know, run platforms in IT, etc. But this whole idea of making it an entire organism, an ecosystem, is something that's about at least perceived abandon of control and mastering new skills, which are more about the algorithms and the control of the nodes, that are a totally different skill set and kind of scary, if that makes sense.
Yes, it reminds me of Apple. In fact, you know, Apple many years ago was considered to be a walled garden. Steve Jobs was very much about controlling everything. You can't, you know, we don't use your software on our Apple machines because your software are. We need to control everything, and somehow. Steve Jobs in the development has got the religion in some ways and built the App Store and with the iPhone and became the most valuable company in the world now in some ways. It's sort of, you know, you describe almost the CPG world in a way that the mindset that Apple had at one point in time, you know, very much controlling, very much being protective of the IP and the knowledge and the operating procedures in some ways.
Yeah, I've heard about this story quite a bit, and you know, against the kind of myth that everything came intuitively and in a genius way to Steve Jobs, it seems that it was not at all intuitive to him, and he had quite some difficulties at the beginning in getting used to the thought of opening up, particularly the App Store, to developers. But that, of course, they then realized, fortunately for them, quite quickly, was a genius stroke, because it generated more and better and faster all these apps that made the big difference of an iPhone that had this ecosystem and this flywheel of, you know, more demand, more apps, more demand, versus the old models, you know, the Blackberries or whatever in the same category that are still following or were still following this pipeline structure of trying to control everything and own everything to a maximum.
Yes, and it's sort of Apple built a system, and this is maybe pointing to what is CPG, where Apple not only benefits you and me using an iPhone, let's say, and having always something new to do on the iPhone, but also it helps the developers, the programmers, if you will, because in the old days, before the App Store, the developer needed to do marketing. They needed to put a product in a shrink wrap package. They needed to sell to the retailer. They needed to promote sales, sell their product to the retailers. So a lot of the, in a way, what it does is it helped, it eliminated some functions that developers didn't want to do in the first place, namely selling and marketing, and they could concentrate really on what they really do well, namely create great apps. And focus on coding and those and ideating new apps. So in a way, it is Apple becomes like this a part of this ecosystem that matches in one side consumers or users of mobile phones with app developers on the other side, and it's almost like a value proposition to both. It's like benefit.
Yep.
It's so in the CPG world, that very same thing should take place. The question I have first, however, is this. Steve Jobs is obviously very smart. He was able to change. He was only reluctantly to change, but he changed. Can CPG change, or does that require a new generation of managers that are not looking at the same level of the organization with, you say, controlling, protecting IP and so forth? Is that, does that, re- is that, can managers change?
Absolutely. I mean, it will change. Some of that change will be the decline or even disappearance of some companies, of course. But, you know, others will evolve. And, you know, let's remember, I mean, some of them have been around for 100 years or more. And obviously, that is proof that they've changed in the past. Will they be able to do it again and in time in the future? You know, it's tough to predict. It's almost like the stock market. But we've had many changes in the CPG industry and even at Procter and even in recent history. And it's a combination of, like you say, new people, new generation coming up, which is constantly happening, of course. And there's been quite some change to great new leaders at P&G recently. And beauty, for example, in particular, which had such a hard time, it seems to be doing great. And it's a big part of leadership, I think, as well. And then you stumble over things, sometimes out of desperation as well. You and I know well the Old Spice, then Axe, then Old Spice again story. Some of the resurgence, for example, of Old Spice was, you know, almost like nothing to lose. We can try something radical. That was purely on a marketing communication and positioning basis, but it shows how, you know, sometimes desperation can force change that leads to fantastic business results and revives the business. And I think a combination of all of this is possible and will happen in CPG as well. I want to come back to one aspect that you mentioned on Apple, which is this a great balance of achieving a win-win, what I would call it, you know, where the developers are happy, they can focus on what they're best at. Apple is obviously happy, they can focus on, you know, what they're best at, which is marketing, the total product bundle. And there's enough money in flowing into this platform to share, and there's a happy balance. That's something that is a flywheel, but also difficult to achieve. And I've seen, you know, traditional pipeline companies starting to do that, obviously. If you think of, for example, in the beauty industry, since I just talked about that, you know, app development there, obviously they've tried to emulate it. Sephora, L'Oreal famously have developed apps, you know, to try on makeup, you know, kind of augmented reality apps. Also ways to share this on social media, Instagram and so forth, to then create product curation and bring in influencers. Some of these things have worked great. What is different though, and is tough, is the move all the way from just adding on some quote unquote gadgets or apps, you know, appendices of having a little bit of an infrastructure here and there, as I just described, to move all the way to a holistic ecosystem. And I think that is as much, if not more, about mindset than it is about capital and so on. You know, it's really looking for every opportunity to make the total business stronger, faster, more agile, more personalized, more transparent also from an equity point of view. And that is the really tough thing. So, you know, adding on little pieces, they do. But then I think there will be such increased complexity that that might either force the change and the turnaround, or, you know, force the decline, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's maybe the in this context, the whole idea of customer centricity, or some call it now customer obsession, actually the wrong way to think about it. You know, it's like, you know, we all singularly, the idea of singularly focusing on consumers, you know, maybe that's wrong. You know, maybe in the platform world it's not just about consumers. It's about the win-win, the balancing out of the various parts of an ecosystem, if you will, or an interaction field, I like to call it.
Yeah, I never liked the expression consumer, even though it's a standard, and I still find myself using it probably 80% of the time, because it feels awkward to say people, but really, talking about the client as the consumer puts such an emphasis already in the wording on they must in the end, you know, take my product and kind of destroy it, right? Consume it so that I can make more of it. So it's this whole force feeding kind of push marketing attitude that stands behind that word, which I think is also a barrier to thinking more openly and maybe about a balanced infrastructure and not one that is all about one way pipeline flows, and actually that the product needs to be kind of fully consumed or destroyed at the end so that you can make new ones, you know?
Yeah. So customer obsession, consumer obsession is a term from the pipeline world in some ways. My question to you is if L'Oreal is basically, L'Oreal is a very successful makeup genius app. It's called 20 million users have downloaded it. If that is just a direction, do you have examples that you would sort of like come to your mind that actually take that a bit further than just a personalization or hyper personalization app like a makeup genius, let's say, from L'Oreal? What would that be?
Right. So I've got two examples that are nice to kind of oppose and contrast, but they're both into the platform and ecosystem world. One is a native platform and ecosystem and kind of a hero there, which is Airbnb, which I absolutely love and which I thought of when the two of us started talking platforms. I guess by now it's over a year ago. And another one on the other end, more traditionally grounded or coming from pipeline, not like Airbnb, kind of a digital and platform native. But on the other end, which you made me aware of, I dug into and I really start to admire, which are actually two, I should say. One is the South African insurance company, health insurance company, or at least it started that way, which is Discovery with the Vitality program. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is Mars Petcare. And as I dig into these two bookends, these two extremes, one is the platform native and the other one is the classic industry that starts to transform into an ecosystem, I see how they can very much both become very successful and compete, and how there's a future where these distinctions no longer apply between, you know, oh, you're a pipeline business and I'm a platform business, but really it's going to be all these mixtures. I mean, even Apple, if we go back to our example, has elements of classic pipeline, which are their iPhones and, you know, the hardware that they sell and so on, and some of the software they make themselves. And then, you know, tons of elements of platform, like, for example, the developer side. So I think that will be true for the future as well. And what I like is that both the Airbnb example, as well as, let's say, the Vitality program in particular, show also the opportunity from not only the business opportunity and perspective, but also from strengthening the brand, making the brand highly relevant and meaningful to people. The classic, what we would we have called the consumer, but also suppliers, etc. And I think that is another very interesting aspect for me as a marketer in that.
Yes. Can you explain a bit more about this Vitality program? For the listener, I think it's not probably not everyone is familiar with that.
Right. So it's fascinating. I mean, the idea is fairly simple, actually, but it always takes genius, right, to start implementing something like this, which is, you know, the insurance business classically is about measuring the risk or, you know, of insuring somebody against, you know, the likelihood of them living to a certain age, or if you're in health insurance, that's life insurance, if you're health insurance, you know, like what the average cost will be over the lifespan, you know, looking at averages, applying, you know, risk factors, etc. I mean, they have a ton of mathematicians, obviously, in the insurance business. What Vitality did was, well, it seems kind of passive and almost stupid to just accept mortality rates and healthcare costs to be a certain way. can't we be in the business also of improving this for everyone, i.e. improving people's health, thus lowering their need for health care, for example, by doing more preventive, but also by being more fit, for example, thus lowering everyone's costs, increasing some of our margins, but also being able to pass on some to the customer and to the suppliers. So kind of create a virtuous cycle that, by the way, which is nice from a branding perspective, nobody could really argue and fight and say it's a bad business thing to kind of try to make people live healthier and longer, thus lowering costs, but also, you know, squeezing costs out of the system and sharing the spoils of it. So basically what Vitality, which is the program name to the insurance, does is it rewards the insured for good, healthy behavior, whether it's running in the park, signing up for a gym, going to preventive medical checks, you know, taking their medication regularly, you name it. It gives you rewards, and it lets you take part in taking better care of you by creating financial incentives or things incentive, like they give away Apple Watches, you know, so you can track your fitness, or, you know, Adidas shoes, which at the same time shows you where the platform comes in. They have tons of other companies that collaborate with them, like Apple, or sports apparel companies, medical companies, hospitals, gyms, and so on.
Fitness centers.
Yes. Yeah. So it's really, and it works so well, and it makes so much sense that I've seen, you know, they're now spreading or have already spread to a ton of countries from originally South Africa, and actually selling this proprietary program to a ton of other companies like AXA or Generali, or, you know, depending on the region, yeah. John Hancock in the US, etc.
So by the interesting thing here is, by you're moving control, which with a normal health insurance company controls basically the premium that you have to pay, the doctors you have to go to, and basically is in the controlling, if you be in the seat of control, you move that to the consumer. So I, as a consumer, am in charge of my health. I sort of like decide how much exercise I do and things like that, that reduce, and by handing the control over to the consumer in some ways, the whole system benefits. I have lower in premiums or insurance rates. The health insurance company makes a better cut. They need to pay out less to the hospitals because I need to go less to the hospitals. And in a way, the health insurance company benefits because I'm longer around for many more years to pay the premium for them. So in some ways, everybody benefits. It's a win-win sort of the entire system.
We're taking a break for now, but we'll release part two of this conversation in a couple weeks. Make sure to tune back in and listen to Eric and JP as they share more examples of businesses embracing change in the CPG space. Thank you for joining us on the Business of Platforms.